The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Frankie Gaffney is a guest this week, and he's the author of the novel Dublin 7 and a writer for the Irish Times. In May this year, he wrote a piece for the Irish Times entitled Identity Politics is Utterly Ineffective at Anything Other than Dividing People, which drew ire online and even inspired a hashtag and an open letter of condemnation. It's Thursday, August 31st, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand late capitalism, pick up Anselm Japp's The Writing on the Wall, which is a collection that brings an understanding of Marx's value theory to bear on political questions. Or find Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies, which is turning out to be a great conversation piece. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books editors and readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with our authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is Put a Lid on It by the Squirrel Nut Zippers. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Frankie Gaffney and I discuss call-out culture and identity politics. Frankie Gaffney is the author of the novel Dublin 7 and a writer for the Irish Times, the Dublin Inquirer, Broadsheet, and many other publications. In May of this year, he wrote a piece for the Irish Times entitled Identity Politics is Utterly Ineffective at Anything Other than Dividing People. At least that's the title I saw online, which drew...
The editor was doing a bit of mischief-making because it wasn't my headline. My original headline was... There's more to privilege than being a straight white man.
Right. Much better.
So they
yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
Anyway, this drew a lot of ire online and even inspired a hashtag and an open letter of condemnation. And the hashtag was Cops on Comrades. And the open letter claimed that the editorial did harm to women and was an attempt to silence them. I don't think so. But Frank Gaffney, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks a million for having me. It's a big honor to be on. Zero Books is lighting up my life at the moment with Kill All Normies and the other stuff that's happening. So I think you're a brave man to be tackling the subjects you're tackling in the current atmosphere.
Yeah, I just didn't. I don't think I, even though I knew, I don't think I realized just how brave I was being.
Same here.
So we'll have to talk a little bit about that. But first off, let me just ask you about your writing. I mean, I'm a novelist as well, but I understand your novel, Dublin 7, has done quite well. Was that your first book?
That's my first novel, yeah. So I kind of came out with nowhere on the literary scene. Nobody had heard of me, and I kind of purposely done that. The first book launch I was ever at was my own, and I didn't want to get contaminated by influenced by other people, you know, in the contemporary scene. I wanted to kind of blaze my own trail, and I felt I had something special to offer because I grew up in a rough background. I got involved in crime, things like that. And then I ended up going to Trinity and getting an amazing opportunity to get a brilliant literary education. So I combined those kind of two world experiences in the book. And I tried to make it very readable, but you can read it on two levels. So it's called Dublin 7. I grew up in Dublin 7, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily set in Dublin. There's seven chapters, and each one corresponds to one of Shakespeare's seven ages of man, mm-hmm. one of the seven deadly sins, one of the seven holy gifts, one of the seven biblical plagues. But it all happens in a year, this young fella's life, when he gets involved in crime. So it's kind of like the underworld, the criminal underworld is like a heightened crucible for life. And I think that's true in real life as well. But I wanted to work on both those levels, both the literary level, and it's just a kind of easy read as well. But I think some of the critics here, it was critically acclaimed, it was a critical success. But I think a lot of the literary stuff didn't get commented upon as much, because I think they kind of pigeonholed the book as being like a crime thriller or something like that. And, you know, that's just not what it is at all. It's literary fiction. Like, there's some quite experimental bits in it and things like that, you know, and just because it's easy to read, I think they kind of underestimated it.
I want to talk about the experience of being on the receiving end of this call out culture, because that's how I think of it. Is it's an approach to using the internet for moral projects and for self definition, I think. But we can go into that. But I want to start with just this concept of identity politics, because that's what your article was at least titled to be about.
Yeah.
And the usual definition of identity politics is really, it's just any political movement focused on helping a particular group. So, for instance, if there was an effort to pass a law to secure equal access to housing for Irish people, who, by the way, really drive down property values when they move in next door, that would be identity politics.
Yeah, Dublin people are even worse. So,
yeah. So, now, you don't think that sort of thing is always divisive?
No, not at all. So, you know, there's been a lot of pressure on me to recant. And I think one of the most common things that said to me is, you need to listen. You need to listen to women. He's not listening to women. He's not listening to all these people. And what they mean when they say listen is, you need to agree. Because I have listened. The reason I wrote the article in the fucking first place was because I was listening and I didn't like what I was hearing, and I still don't like. So they haven't convinced me. But the thing is, I was involved in identity politics. I've been, you know, involved in refugee welcome campaigns going back to when I was in school. I've campaigned on other issues. My ma is gay, you know what I mean? I'm all in favor of LGBT rights. She's a campaigner as well. You know, stuff like this. So we never referred to any of that stuff as identity politics. So the only kind of reservation I have about the article that I wrote was, I should have made that distinction, that identity politics to me and to the people that I talk to is this new style of language and new style of praxis. That's kind of an online phenomenon, and, you know, associated with privilege theory and associated with, you know, this kind of, you know, some of the words that I objected to and some of the stigmatizing of outgroups. So objecting to every single generalization, whether true or not, statistically about women, for example, but feeling anybody who objects to any generalization about straight white men, which I happen to be, but I'm a lot more than that. I'm a lot more than that. I don't like my identity being reduced to three dimensions of supposed privilege, given what we had to face growing up and given what I had to face in this country. So I do accept the criticism, but I don't accept it because of social pressure. I accept it because of self-reflection, that the distinction probably should have been clearer about identity politics and what that means.
No, you know, there are critiques of identity politics, even on the level of just like focusing on obtaining rights for oppressed groups. And the critique, I think, from the left would be, while this is necessary, it's not sufficient to achieve the kinds of structural changes in society that we need to achieve. So if you're always battling to earn this or that group equal access to this system, what you're maybe not doing is working on a universal politics to change the system itself. Now, the problem with that critique is, you know, even the political movement to make universal changes to the economic system so that it's a better system and more like socialism, say, even that movement will be operating under in a society where there are lots of divisions and inequalities. So you have to be concerned about identity within your movement. as you're making, even as you're making a universal change. And so it's like a complicated problem, the way that we are unequally oppressed and suppressed in society based on these different identities. But you can critique a politics of identity that's even good by saying, hey, this always goes only so far. We need to go further. We need a universal politics. Would you agree with that critique of identity politics?
Probably not, you know. I think, you know, I put it succinctly, you know, as succinctly as I could when I said identity politics is great insofar as it champions the rights of specific groups. Identity politics is shit when it identifies other groups and stigmatizes and makes generalizations about them. So I'm hostile to identity politics only insofar as identity politics is hostile to me as a straight white man, as a straight white working class man, you know. As well as that, then I would also have a problem, and I think it's a big problem in Ireland, though I'm just bewildered by it, with a lot of people. They talk about race, they talk about gender, and they talk about sexuality, right? And they don't talk about class at all. So I've no problem with somebody talking about race. I've no problem with someone talking about gender. I've no problem with someone talking about sexuality. I've been involved in some of those campaigns and some of those politics. But why lump the three of them together and leave out class? Why do people say straight white male and leave out class and leave out language group and leave out ethnicity and leave out religion and all of these other dimensions? It's because of neoliberalism. It's feeding the neoliberal agenda. There's no justification for it. And I think one of the most interesting and revealing things after I wrote the article was the mental gymnastics people perform trying to build a reverse scaffolding for the term straight white male, the random lumping together of those particular three dimensions. You know, they just would not concede that perhaps it was unjustified to lump those three things in together and focus on those specific three things to the neglect of other things. So if you're talking about race, you know, I'm, the other thing is as well, I've no problem with people making generalizations. Like, some of the best crack I see on the internet is people making generalizations about men or making generalizations about women. The only problem we have with it is when it's coming from people who object in the most vociferous terms to any generalizations that go in a direction that they don't like. So, you know, there's some sinister there, and there's some element of trying to just dominate the discourse and dominate the spaces that has nothing to do with equality.
Well, let's talk about class. I think one of the things when I was listening to you on a different podcast, the women's podcast for the Irish Times, that frustrated me was I thought you ceded too much ground around the topic of class. Now, it may be that you and I just have too much, I mean, that we don't have the same politics exactly, or we have a different conception of class. But from my perspective as a kind of wannabe Marxist, the notion of class is really different from other notions like gender or...
Oh, absolutely. I think it is different, yeah. So, sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to interrupt to agree with you vociferously. Yeah. So go ahead and...
Yeah, the difference is, like, you could be born to people who are working class and end up not being working class yourself when you go out into the world. That happens.
Yeah, but the actions on a lot of my detractors, that's happened, so...
Yeah. I mean, it also happens that people who are born into the bourgeois class fall into the working class. That's happening more and more, which is why you've got a lot of people who are coming from middle class backgrounds who are, like, in the United States supporting Bernie Sanders because they don't see their bourgeois future ahead of them. But the main thing about it is class isn't about who you are. It's about what you do, what you're driven to do to survive, and what your relationship is to the means of production. So to talk about class, you're talking about something that isn't really connected to any given set of cultural markers. And, you know, it's not, you can be born in London, you can be born in Somalia, you can be born in Los Angeles, you could be born in different neighborhoods, you could end up in the working class. The working class is a structure in society that, like, shapes pretty much everything, that relationship between capital and worker. And once you start talking about class, you're not talking about an identity politics anymore. You are talking about this universal structure in society.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I've said in one of the podcasts, the podcast that started all the trouble, the powwow, you know, that we got objected to, because using the word powwow was cultural appropriation. And I said in that the definition of working class in Ireland, let's say, people tend to think of someone with my accent. But I think it's much, much broader than that. There's, you know, people that have to sell their labour to survive. Essentially, you know, I think we need to broaden the terms. I do think that there is a cultural element. So, for example, my dialect, certain values are a hangover, let's say, from the industrial proletariat in Dublin, things like that. So, you know, back in the day, we would have all spoken the same. We would have all had this culture and been much more homogenous. But I think that's changed. You know, there's loads of people as well. Look, so many people, when I go in to talk to schools, they ask me to go in and talk to schools kind of as an example of a bad boy done good kind of thing. And I can see the teachers kind of wince because I say to the kids, look, you know, mates that I have that are working in hairdressing or working in the trades, a lot of them are fucking making loads of money. And loads of people that I know that are working as professionals or certainly academics are, you know, absolutely fucking flat broke. And they're the new precariat. They're getting squeezed for hours. The working conditions are terrible. You know, all the lads I know that have trades and didn't go to university are doing better now. So you know, I think those people need, those professionals and things like that need to see themselves, and people like me should be make more of an effort to bring them in and not be, you know, defining working class as someone who speaks like me and dresses like I dress, you know what I mean, and someone that's had the life that I've had.
I think,
it needs to be focused back on a set of social relations, but, you know, maybe, you know, the terminology is so loaded now at this stage that it's kind of difficult to fight, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, we talk about the middle class, but when Marx was writing about the middle class and the bourgeoisie, they had servants. You know, they owned property. Right. They didn't have a fucking job that they were meant to be working from 9 to 5, but they're working from 9 till 8, and they don't have money to pay their electricity bill. So the terms are straining under the weight of the dialectic.
You know, I was the other day I was watching a YouTube video of a lecturer from this guy who lived to be 104. Now suddenly I can't remember his name, but it was a literary critic and historian, and they were asking him, why is it that, you know, 100 years ago, the books that were written were, you know, so much more complex and rich, and why is it that a writer would produce so many different kinds of books and so many different, you know, the tendency to be prolific was just much more common 100 years ago. And he said, well, it's a very simple answer. They had servants. You know, your typical writer didn't have to wash his own dishes or prepare his own meals. And even if they weren't particularly wealthy, it was the kind of necessity that you would think of, you know, it's like your electrical bill today. You have to have your servants, even if you have no money at all. You'll borrow to keep your servants around.
That's it. Yeah, I like that analogy with the electricity. Yeah,
right. So I'm not sure what I'm getting at, but I guess yes, that even impoverished bourgeois people had a different kind of relationship with their fellow man than they do today. In the United States, we don't have as clear a conception of class that we acknowledge. Like, there are differences between rural people and urban people and educated people and uneducated people, but we don't ever really talk about
blue
class.
Collar was the phrase I always heard when I was in the States. You know, it was always, he's a blue collar guy or something like that. You know,
blue collar, white collar. Yeah, that's still there. But that's declining, you know, every year because of the industrial base of U.S. economy. It's still there, but it's more and more automated.
Hit it, Joe!
The convergence of these technologies will create jobs in areas we can't even think of.
But these days, Wadhwa is singing a different, dolorous tune.
Technology is moving faster than anyone believes, and that it's going to disrupt industries and create unemployment on a scale that we haven't imagined before.
Why did you used to think it wasn't going to be a problem?
Because I believed what people in Silicon Valley do, that technology will make everything all right. I've had debates with the who's who of Silicon Valley, and I sit back and think, these people live in their own world, that they don't know poverty, they don't know despair, they don't know what the impact of unemployment is.
People in the Silicon Valley believe that what we're doing is God's work. We are making the world a better place.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about identity politics. And I wonder if one thing we might consider is, rather than critiquing identity politics in the future, we might think about critiquing this notion that politics are personal, that the politics come down ultimately to personal experiences. Because those things do motivate people to enter the arena of politics, but they only go so far. You have to start thinking beyond yourself in order to really have a political perspective. So what do you think about that idea that we would critique the idea that politics are personal, or everything is political, including the personal, which is something that came out of the 70s.
I would be, you know, of the kind of mindset that everything is political. But, you know, I think getting away from the personal in terms of critique is incredibly important for two reasons, or in two dimensions. Mm-hmm. So number one, there's public representatives here, TDs in the Dáil, so members of parliament, that are very, very middle class, right? Went to private schools, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they're fucking brilliant. They're some of the best representatives we have, socialists, right?
Uh-huh.
And I don't look at them when they're fighting for my rights and go, oh, look at him, that bourgeois guy, you know, that middle class guy, he shouldn't be talking about this. He didn't live that life. I think, Jesus Christ, you know, they came so far, they rejected their own kind of privilege, if you want to use the word. Try to avoid privilege at all costs, but I think maybe in that sentence.
They rejected their own class interests, is another way to put it.
Yeah, they rejected their own class interests. Exactly. So I think the other one is much more important, the other dimension that this is important to consider. And I will 100% acknowledge my continuing guilt in this crime. So I'm going to be massively hypocritical and advise people to do as I say, not as I do. But I'm trying to tell myself this all the time as well. So, you know, in Ireland here, we've had scandals recently with the Garda Commissioner, for example. And what's been happening is precisely what happened in the war. I think the war is one of the best programs. It was like so much heuristic value into how the political system is impersonal. It's a system that we're all enthralled to at every level. And even the people that go in wanting to do change end up getting sucked into, you know, for example, the numbers game, statistics, meeting quotas, and this kind of stuff. Acts have unintended consequences at different levels of society and things like that. So, you know, there's loads of calls for the Garda Commissioner to resign. You know, the last one resigned. He was a blustering buffoon. This one won't resign. You know, she's a disaster as well, comes from exactly the same culture. The police here are a complete nightmare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the thing is, though, getting another commissioner from that same police force is going to achieve precisely nothing. To changing the commissioner this time achieved precisely nothing. And isolated that commissioner, you know, in print, the last commissioner and stuff like that, and I've slated this commissioner in print, I've slated various politicians at various times, and it's very tempting to go off with his head and think you're going to achieve something. Like when they got rid of that journalist there, Kevin Myers, you know, all the people were, you know, incensed at an article that he wrote, but he's been writing objectionable articles for two decades, and you know, the system that he's writing in is going to do much more damage than he ever could. And that's the same is exactly true of those politicians and the civil servants and the people in these jobs. So we need systemic change, not personal change. And that those kind of personal attacks all the time kind of distract us from the reality of what would make significant changes. And again, that's something that I'm as guilty of as anyone, both in print and in online and in personalized. The thing is, though, you know, the only call-out culture I've engaged in the past is calling out, you know, the Prime Minister or people like that, or, you know, very, very high-profile public figures that are, I don't think, going after individuals and harassing them and attacking them like that, you know, is morally justifiable at all.
I would agree with you there. I don't know. I think it's always a balancing act, but there are times when taking out a political opponent and attacking him personally might not be the justifiable thing rationally, but it's like so pragmatically useful that it's impossible to resist, maybe. So let me ask you this question about your own experience now. We've been saying that, yeah, your experience doesn't matter, but maybe we can start with your experience and then try to make some universal claims. Do you have any idea why it is that your article caused the reaction that it did on the level it did? Or to put it differently, why is it that crossing lines or critiquing this sort of politics seems to always get such a huge reaction?
Well, there's a brilliant feminist in Ireland, Catherine McCartney, and she said what I had done was put my hand on the curtain like the Wizard of Oz, and I was about to pull back the curtain and reveal that the Wizard of Oz, you know, wasn't exactly magical after all. And I think that's true. I think, you know, it's ideological insecurity that's heaving under the weight of contradictions. It's riddled with hypocrisy. You know, the generalizations thing, you know, it's become more and more about normalizing and mainstreaming attacks on men and masculinity and white people and things like this, you know, that, like, you know, is completely counterproductive and hypocritical given the extent to which they object to anything that goes in the other direction. So, you know, so on one side, they're trying to shut down any kind of discourse, and on the other side, they're trying to open it up. And the level of hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance involved must be hard for anyone to bear. So when it's pointed out to them, it probably feels bad. You know what I mean? Nobody likes to have their failures or their inconsistencies in their thinking or their hypocrisies. Yeah, so I think there's also a kind of a group think, and, you know, in-group, out-group, you know, very basic psychological thing going on, you know, where you enforce group coherence by attacking out-groups. And, you know, it's just kind of basic psychological thing. It's kind of playground stuff, really, isn't it? You know, I mean, you know, really, the behavior of them is it's off the wall, you know. It's,
right.
It's for people that talk about fucking fairness and morality and things like this. You know, you have and it's not just me. Like, it's loads of people. You go onto their pages, and they're there slating other individuals. A lot of the time, they'll be slating some person who's just a regular job or a regular Jane. And they're there talking shit about them online publicly, you know, in big groups, you know, this kind of thing. Right. And you're like, fucking 13-year-old kids learn not to behave like that in school. Yeah, that kind of bullying has kind of, you know, been eradicated in schools to a large extent from what it was back in the day. And then you have these fucking grown-ass bleeding men and women, you know, who think it's all right to behave like this. And worst of all, they're the most moralistic, pious, sanctimonious fucking people that I've ever encountered in my life. So it's wild. I mean, they're on a power buzz into the next stratosphere. It's crazy stuff that they're getting themselves involved in. I've been kind of smeared as an alt-right apologist and alt-right and all of that, you know what I mean? So I want to say now on the record, fuck the alt-right. So I teach a little bit in Trinity, and I've never been told to give trigger warnings or to, you know, safe spaces or any of this kind of stuff, you know what I mean? So I think it can be a little bit overestimated. It hasn't hit here to the same extent that it has. It serves the political purposes to kind of some people's political purposes to overestimate it. Outside the academy, you know, on fucking left Twitter, you know, the space is totally being dominated by absolutely lunatics. But again, I suppose one of the things that made me intensely skeptical of this type of politics is when I went to Trinity as an undergraduate. So I've been involved in crime, you know, got myself into pretty serious trouble with violence and you know, stuff like that. And I got a lucky opportunity to escape it because I had no exams or anything, you know, failed me leaving cert. So I was able to go as a mature student. They were able to waive the requirements and get in on based on interviews and a piece of writing. So I took that and ran with it and excelled at Trinity. But I found myself immersed in post-colonial theory and, you know, some of these theories. And I remember reading them, and I'd been involved in politics before I got involved in crime and stuff like that. I'd been involved in political activism from when I was in school, and that kind of fell by the wayside then when I was starting to get myself into trouble. So I kind of had a bit of experience of the picket lines and things like this. And I went in and, you know, had these really fucking privileged people. And I mean privileged. I don't mean privileged in that stupid sense that's being bandied around now. I mean people that actually had au pairs, people that actually, you know, never had to worry about rent, about mortgages, about things like this. You know, had their parents put everything on a fucking plate for them, went to private school, all of this kind of stuff. So I had them, you know, kind of posturing about liberation theology and, you know, these kind of works that seem to me to be written with the sole aim of being impenetrable. It bore no relation to any kind of activism or anything I had been involved in. And I'd never met any of these people, you know, in political things and things like this. So it seemed very, very self-serving and very wanky, to be honest. So that kind of made me skeptical. That's one of the reasons then. So after I finished the English degree, I went and I did a master's in linguistics, and now my PhD is not very political at all. There's a bit of sociolinguistics in it, but it's mostly analysing literature using linguistics. And you know, this kind of idea that you know, paid, you know, you can't dress up your paid work as activism and public service in the same sense that people who sacrifice time or take risks, you know, have skin in the game, do. But I thought that there was a lot of that posturing, not in Trinity, but I mean in the general, the ideology and theory that was being kind of bandied around. And, you know, it just was like water off a duck's back, you know what I mean? I was like, this is having no impact on me and has little or no heuristic value beyond kind of learning how to reproduce that soil and replicate that kind of style of bullshit, you know?
I have anecdotes from people who I know who are on the left and you know, who've considered themselves quite radical, who are complaining and sounding sometimes like Tucker Carlson about this stuff. Because you know, they're saying, oh yeah, I know some a professor who was brought up on Title IX for reprimanding a student for being late or something along those lines. I know there's a very big case with Laura Kipnis where she was given a Title IX infraction for having published an essay that the student thought was triggering or was an attack on her personally. Yeah. But these are, you know, this is an American problem because you don't have Title IX. You don't have the same legislation in Ireland. So who knows what's going to happen next here. But there are institutional and legal reasons why the universities are particularly precarious places right now.
I suppose, I do have to admit that even among the kind of people who'd be more invested in this kind of stuff, you know, in the academic world that I've encountered, I haven't really encountered it in the academic world where people are, you know, kind of trying to be oppressive with it, you know what I mean? Like, it hasn't kind of hit here. There is a kind of, you know, I like the atmosphere here. There's a plurality. Now, you know, the thing is, though, the class thing, I mean, you know, it's staggering that, I went to Trinity and the gender balance was good. You know, I mean, there was more men than women in my undergrad courses, things like that. The gender balance in the faculty seems to be, you know, spot on like that as well. But the class balance, you know, I mean, maybe 2% of the university population spoke like me. Now, if you can imagine a black person going in and into that environment, and there's only, you know, that level of minority in the city where they grew up, you know, and say, imagine it was, you know, a university in Johannesburg, or imagine a woman going in and, you know, it's 2% women. That'd be an issue that'd be on the radar. but it wasn't on the radar at all. Nobody's talking about it. You know, you're open on the University Times and the magazines and things like this, and there's articles about feminism and gender diversity and race diversity as well in Ireland, you know?
This is where I have to say, like, come on, what are you talking about? Of course there isn't going to be much of a representation of the working class and, you know, the higher levels of education. Why would you want, or what purpose would a working class person achieve by getting a PhD?
Well, no, I don't mean a PhD level. I mean an undergraduate level.
Well, even okay, or even necessarily, if they're actually like long-term working class people. I mean, like, okay, forget about them individually, because there's a lot they can achieve individually. But if they're going to stay in the working class, then they're not going to get anything out of a bachelor's degree, even, or not much, because go ahead.
Yeah, I suppose again, what I really mean is the kind of blind spot in terms of, so, you know, we had the equality referendum here, and equality was the watchword on everybody's lips, and I thought it was fantastic. But equality wasn't being applied to all of those dimensions. You know, again, it was being thought of in terms of race, in terms of gender, but not in terms of class, you know what I mean? Because equality in class terms implies, getting rid of private schools. You know, employs serious, serious inheritance tax. You know, I think the inheritance tax should be 100%. So, you know, it's that kind of blind spot. But if you take their logic to its conclusion, you can hammer them on those issues. You know, I'm talking more so about, let's say, liberals and neoliberals.
Yeah.
You know, who pay lip service to this. But okay, if you want to talk equality, let's talk equality.
Yeah.
And you know, they're soon changes.
Well, see, here's the thing. Here's the thing. What you're talking about really is class mobility. You're saying there's not enough class mobility at Trinity or you know, in Ireland.
No.
Because once you get into the level of the kind of middle class, because the whole point, one of the major points of higher education is to groom a certain segment of the population to be parts of the managerial and bourgeois class. So,
yeah,
so you get people who are working class, more working class people in that position. Then what you're doing is they're moving out of the working class and somebody else is going to be taking their place, either by just more babies being born or by someone falling from a class position. And so what you're talking about is class mobility. You know, in the United States, we have, I think, more class mobility than you do in Ireland. I don't know. I'm making that up, but it seems like it's my impression. It doesn't necessarily mean that, that you've got – that anything has changed for working class people today for there to be that – because the working class has to be a certain size and in a certain position for the society to function. So you – I remember when I was a kid, in elementary school, I acted up and wandered around and caused enough trouble in classes to be put in the slower reading group for a while. It turned out I could read pretty well, but
that's a surprise.
When I was in that reading group, I asked the teacher, I said, so if we all learn to read, can we all go up to can this group stop being the lower reading group? And she said, well, no, this group will always be the lower reading group, but one at a time, some of you will go up. And I said, so this is like permanent. This is a position in – someone's got to be in the lower reading group. And it's, and she's like, well, yeah. And I was like, okay. And I realized, that in a way the situation was sort of fucked.
Yeah, well, Carl Parkinson is a poet and novelist. Who I've become close to since my book came out, and he comes from the flats, I suppose you would call them, the projects, and a rougher background than I did, and he's superb poet and things like that. But again, I suppose it comes back to that definition of class that I was talking about, that the hangover from the cultural hangover from the industrial proletariat that is not the cultural inheritance of people that you would define, many people that you would define as working class if you were to base it on their social relations. So Carl says that, he feels he should be defined as underclass, or something like that. You know, because his unpolished diamond that came out of nowhere in these flats where there was just absolutely no opportunities and things like that. And that's different again from people whose parents are about working and things like that. It's kind of it's a subclass, let's say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky, complex subject, and you know, some of the criticism that's been leveled at me in terms of the definition of class and things like that, you know, I absolutely accept. Or accept it's legitimate. I don't know if I fully go along with it.
Yeah.
But that's some of the more criticism that I think is in the grounds of debate, discourse, and fair play. You know.
Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, I think that these are the kind of conversations that we need to have, just to be able to formulate political projects and see what is going to work the best to really changing society. Because I have this commitment to socialism, to this idea that we can really get out from under capitalism eventually.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we have to be able to talk about these things. One thing I wanted to get into with you, and then I think we might be coming to the end of our conversation, but what have you found to be the most successful strategy for responding to the amount of criticism and smears that you've received online? Like, how have you dealt with that, and what do you think works best when
you know? I don't know. I'm totally in two minds. So on the one hand, I wouldn't stoop to their level. You know, there's been absolute fabrications, you know, purposely mistranscribed podcasts and things like that, you know, making me say things I didn't say. I've been accused. If I get accused one more time of believing stuff I don't believe, or not believe in stuff I do believe, I'm going to explode. So on the one hand, people kind of advise me, don't rise to it, you know, don't feed the trolls, this kind of attitude. And I went along like that for so long, but it's 3 months now. So, you know, lately I've started, I don't like call-out culture, you know, Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, now what happens is if someone starts misrepresenting me or someone starts lying, I'll just quote tweet them. And it's like pulling up a rock and watching Beatles run back into the darkness, because when you do that, they don't like it. They don't like it at all. They don't like a taste of their own medicine. But it's amazing, you know, the things that they've said about me. And, you know, you have, you know, WhatsApp groups with hundreds of people and they're sharing stuff and saying things about me that aren't true. And then when I just retweet, or, you know, so there was anonymous accounts yesterday, and I asked, right, does anyone know who this person is? And I was told who it was. And they went, oh my God, you're a scumbag. You're trying to get him doxxed. You know what I mean? Like, you're trying to dox him, all of this kind of stuff. And I wasn't. No, this person's been talking about me for fucking 3 months online. And then, you know, it's amazing the tolerance levels that they have compared to what they think other people should put up with. You know, I mean, listen, if they're listening, these are dirty, sleazy little offense archaeologists. That's what Freddie DeBoer called them. They've gone through every tweet that I've ever had, and they found, you know, they found one tweet that they think is proof of my misogyny, and they're all rejoicing about that. You know, one tweet, a pro-life account, kind of gave me a bit of shit, and I tweeted back about a sexual practice that doesn't result in pregnancy. And they're saying that's proof of my misogyny and stuff like this. So, you know, they're sleazy, stalkerish, weird, fucking, you know, obsessive people. And you know, the thing is, they don't like the spotlight being thrown on them. I said as well, I think that, you know, this analogy got me into trouble, but I don't give a fuck now at this stage. It was liberating being denounced and being kicked out. You know, of that exiting the vampire castle, let's say, as Mark Fisher put it. It was liberating, because I was just like, right, I'm not fucking doing this anymore. I'm not going to not have a joke about something, you know, when you know, innocently, or I'm not going to police my language all the time and this kind of stuff. You know, kind of self-censorship and things like this. I'll say what I want. I'm not homophobic. I'm not racist. I'm not sexist. I'm not a misogynist. And, you know, if you think that those things are serious charges, you should have serious fucking evidence before you go accusing people of them. You know, so it shows that, you know, their insincerity, that they don't think charges like that demand serious evidence. What? So they obviously don't take the stuff seriously.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing about the racist, sexist, misogynist, all that, those charges, is that there's two ways to approach this question. One is, are you personally an ideological misogynist? Are you personally an ideological homophobe? Right? And then, so you can say to that easily, no, I am not. But then they can ask you questions like, you know, what about deep down inside, in a little, some crevice somewhere? Do you still hold some feeling that might pop up every once in a while? Yeah. If you get into an elevator with a black guy, do you stiffen up? You know, come on, let's look. And, you know, at that level, I know for me personally, I have to say, yeah, well, look, I have memories of saying racist things in my past. I have memories of reacting in a way that I don't like. There are lots of things about me around these issues that I don't like and that I don't agree with my own self about. And you say that, and say, oh, then you are a misogynist. So that's like supposed to be a good thing. It's like you get in touch with the things that you don't like. You try to overcome them, so sort of self-education and that kind of thing. But then if you're the target of one of these things, that just shifts over into you being an ideological misogynist, racist, homophobe, whatever. And so the one kind of thing that you'll accept, I'm every other white person who has privilege in America, say, I have some racist ideas that I try to stamp out, you know?
Yeah.
That you say that, and then, oh yeah, look, he's a racist, a self-confessed racist, that kind of thing. So, it's just wiggly.
Yeah. I suppose I repurposed the Oscar Wilde quote to kind of explain the fervor of their antipathy towards what I'd said. You know, the article's been reread. You know, like 90% of the people that attacked me over the article did not attack me on the words that I used. The letter said that I used alt-right language. Now, I purposely don't use terms like cook, like SJW, like snowflake, you know, things like that, because I despise those terms. You know, so that's alt-right language. You know, nowhere in the article did I use alt-right language. I put it in simple, bleeding English, because I'm sick of all of this wanky political theory that doesn't mean fucking anything to 90% of the working class. But, you know, what I said about some of their anger was that I repurposed a quote from the start of Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And I said, when I talk about class, their anger is the rage of Caliban not seeing his face in the mirror, you know. And I said, when I talk about, you know, their use of straight white male and this kind of stuff, and say that it's neoliberal, that's the rage of Caliban seeing his face in the mirror. So I think that kind of explains what's going on to a large extent. They're being presented with the problems on their own side of the house, and they don't like it.